This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio, and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight, and me, Samuel Mann. Shane's not here tonight because this time I'm in Wellington. Each week we talk with somebody making a positive difference, and we try to find out what motivates them, what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens is that of Dr. Bethana Jackson, Senior Lecturer in the School of Geography, Environment and Earth Sciences at Victoria University. We're in the Cotton Building. Big name in New Zealand geography.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
Let's go right back to the start, shall we? Where'd you grow up?
Mostly I grew up in Pukekohe, so a little bit south of Auckland, then a rural town, and I'm now part of the big Auckland super city.
And what did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a pirate, and then I wanted to be a vet, and all kinds of other things, and then I tried to sign myself out of mathematics courses when I went to university to do geophysics. And then eventually I majored in mathematics and then in environmental engineering, and now I teach and research in a geography department, so fairly interdisciplinary.
What led you to maths?
They gave me scholarships. They actually had some really cool research once I actually got to university. They were very engaged and inspiring, and they weren't just doing equations, but they were doing research into Antarctic sea ice and acoustics, and all kinds of fun things.
Because you turned it into applied maths.
I turned it into applied maths, that's right. And then I ended up doing a PhD. This is where I left New Zealand for London. And I did a PhD looking at how radioactive substances might accumulate in the subsurface and come into plants and get taken up potentially by animals and humans.
Was that a particular interest, or was that a PhD
available? It was completely accidental. I applied for a job and they said, yes, we'll give you the job if you do a PhD on the side.
Sounds good. What did you find?
I found that, yes, some radioactive substances can accumulate in plants. I learnt a lot of, really interesting skills in terms of the importance of soil and how chemicals go around the world. And, I just learnt a lot of skills. And then I did a postdoc, which was looking at the impacts of land management on flood risk. And it was very much just looking at sustainability just from the perspective of floods. We were working with farmers in a Welsh catchment, and they were saying it's all very well to look at how we might plant trees to reduce flood risk for the people 400 kilometres downstream who built their cities and houses on floodplains. We don't want to flood them, but it's pretty hard for us to make a living, but show us where we can put those trees in places that will not just help the people downstream, but will also bring more biodiversity back into our own landscape and not cut our bottom line too much. And sure, we're interested in exploring that. So I started to get interested in sustainability from different perspectives that way.
It doesn't seem like an obvious route into that sort of problem from maths.
No, well, I think the thing is I went to university not wanting to do maths but wanting to do environmental science, geophysics, and then I ended up going into maths and also using that partly to solve geophysical problems, and then I think I kind of came back to what was at least one of my passions. So, yeah.
What has the maths route taught you?
One of the things that I learned from some of my students and a lot of the people trying to do research in physical geography and other environmental sciences is they all say, I really wish I had more math skills. So I guess what going through the maths has taught me is that there's just an awful lot of skills in that are really necessary to solving environmental problems.
Were your lecturers, when you were studying, were they pure mathematicians that that sort of like saw these annoying people trying to apply it, or how what was the sort of structure of that?
I guess there was a bit of a mix of that, but I did go down the applied maths route, which I think is because I do like applying the mathematics to actual problems in the world. And I think, though, there was quite a crossover, I think, between physics and the more applied maths as well. So, yes, there are some people who like to do the blue skies mathematics, and that can be fun too, any kind of blue sky science. And a lot of that blue skies then ends up being incredibly useful and actually helping solve applied problems. But I guess I always wanted to do something to help change the world. So
I was talking to someone the other day who was telling me that the way to get to the cutting edge of any pure discipline is actually to try applying it, and you suddenly realise that the things that you thought were going to work don't, and that's where the interesting questions come from.
That's absolutely true. And in fact, when I did my master's thesis, I did it in a fairly esoteric branch of numerical mathematics, and I came into environmental science going, oh, well, this is easy, we know this, you know, we've known how to solve these problems for 40-50 years. But actually, when you look at environmental problems, you've got these really different changing forcing. So for example, you have earthquakes, you have large rainfall events, you have changing evaporation, you have all kinds of external forces on the system that disrupt it, and then it tries to come back to equilibrium. And I think a lot of the fun maths problems kind of ignore the complicated forcings and boundary conditions we see in the real world. So yes, I came along and tried to apply my applied math skills, and they were extremely useful, but yes, also found it wasn't quite as easy as I'd thought in the esoteric maths land.
You say that some of the people that you're working with wish that they had more maths.
Almost all students, in fact, I come across in geography in particular, at master's level or at PhD level, anyone doing research, they wish they had more maths and often more stats. And sometimes, you know, many other skills as well, and we can't learn everything in our classes for sure, but some of the quantitative skills are particularly difficult because they're kind of building blocks, and so they're harder to pick up than some others.
Do you think the people coming through maths wish they had more human?
More human. There's also a difference in terms of maths quantitative and then the physical process understanding. But yes, sure, there's also the whole kind of social science side, and I'm very interested in that as well, because it's one thing building nice models of how the world works and building mathematical equations and saying we can predict these things, but it's a very different thing to actually then understand how people might react to those and get uptake, and the different things that influence decision making are not necessarily straightforward. So there's a lot of need for interdisciplinarity for sure between the physical sciences and the human sciences, or the social sciences. And I think there's another disjoint, I think, in terms of the quantitative, the mathematical sciences, and then the physical understanding of how the world works and how you might then encapsulate that in mathematics and vice versa.
If we argue for the moment that you can put people on a scale of reductionist at one end and systems at the other, where do you put yourself on that?
I'm a systems thinker.
Even though it's systems thinking,
you might have a different definition of systems thinking to me.
I'll go with your definition. But do you have to reduce things down to get to the mathematical?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm trying to understand how to reduce reality to something that has enough of the main processes and drivers. What's the definition of a model? I mean, it's a simplified representation of the system that somewhat mimics the reality, or the excitation response relations, I think, is one definition.
So now you're at Vic.
Yep.
And teaching hydrology and climate. I looked this up, you said.
I'm teaching the hydrology part of hydrology and climate. Mm-hmm. I'm teaching the hydrology part of hydrology and geomorphology. And in both times, trying to link climate to hydrology and hydrology to geomorphology, etc.
Yep. So at what point did you pick up the hydrology?
In my PhD, so I would have done a little bit of it in geology at Auckland. But mostly because my PhD was focused on modelling water and modelling chemicals moving through water in soils and plants. So it was accidental, but I'm now a real water geek.
There's gumboots in your office.
There are, yeah. No, I get out into the field, I get muddy.
So what are you focusing on now in terms of your research?
My main research focus is taking forward a framework we call LUCI, the Land Utilisation and Capability Indicator. So it's looking at how land management can change different outcomes, primarily at the moment environmental, partly because they're the most easy for us to predict. So we predict how if you change, say, irrigation practices or plant some trees in the middle of a field or do riparian planting, modify how you put fertiliser on, how all that plays out in terms of changing flooding, water quality, sediment in your rivers, how extending a corridor of a particular habitat might increase the ability of a species to migrate under climate change, or how fragmentation of habitats might help protect our iconic New Zealand species, agricultural productivity. So basically trying to look at how changing land management changes a whole lot of different environmental and social and economic outcomes.
So you'd have to walk us through how would you even begin to approach that? Is it it's land use... As in land use capability, as in soil classification?
Yes, so we've taken soil, we've taken topography, we've taken climate data, and then we look at the capability, and we also look at where that landscape is, where a packet of land is positioned in relation to everything else. So is it collecting a whole lot of water or sediment from, a gully just uphill of it or whatever? And then we look at the capability of it. So we say, here's what this the current configuration of the landscape, you're using it, it's grazed grassland or you've got some gorse, whatever it might be, and this is what this is doing for the landscape. This has, positive biodiversity benefits, not necessarily the gorse, but whatever it might be. Does it have positive or negative biodiversity benefits? Are there things you could do to this landscape to actually enhance it from this perspective? And what happens when we look at all of these multiple outcomes? Are there win-wins for change? Is this particular feature in the landscape incredibly important? If we remove that, does that then pose a danger for, again, flooding downstream or a breakage in the connectivity of a habitat corridor, for example?
So is there an underlying model? How are you doing stuff?
Yeah, there's a whole lot of models underneath, sure.
Based on each land unit?
Based on each land unit and based on how each land unit connects to each other. So we consider, the topography, the soil information, the land use information. Again, yes, the rainfall, the climate. If you've got geological information, then you use that. And those all get layered together, and then we look at how they connect to each other. And so, for example, masses track through the landscape. So you might start off, someone puts some fertilizer up on a field, and then we track how that goes down through the landscape, whether potentially nitrogen might get caught by a riparian strip or some particularly permeable landscape, or whether it all kind of ends up in the stream. So we look at not just at what's put onto the landscape, but also where it ends up.
And I can see how that would work on an individual thing, but you've also got it somehow talking to other bits of land?
Yes, exactly, yes. So it's all linked up. And so literally, again, you put a piece of mass on a landscape, you also look at what's coming down, and you are literally tracking it as it moves under various energy drivers. So, gravity is the main thing that's driving, fundamentally driving water and driving chemicals, but pressure gradients and kinetic energy. And so we're basically tracking the energy gradients. Everything's linked up. We work at the resolution of the elevation information we have, whether it's in New Zealand or whether it's in another country. So, for example, we often try and model the landscape every 5 metres by 5 metres. So we're just tracking what happens between each 5 metre by 5 metre square in the landscape. So we take in all the connections, and that's what we're really interested in, is the connections and how things change over scales. So from a sustainability perspective, I'm really interested in how sustainable decisions about sustainable land management change over scales and between local landowners, regional councils, government, and all the various balances that happen. So I don't want this windmill in my backyard, but I also want energy generation to be at my household, etc.
And how far, if you're at a 5 meter scale, somebody downstream in a river, there's an awful lot of 5 meter cells away.
Yep. That's where the maths was really useful, because I learnt tricks to solve the mathematical equations much faster than is normal.
And does it... people have talked about the problems with the discount rate, that whatever you set the discount rate to, things in the future never turn out to matter. Do you get the same sort of effect over space?
If you make... Oh, that's a really tricky question. I would say not if you actually went and did a really coherent plan. So I think if you went and did a really coherent plan, making a whole lot of small-scale interventions, that you could actually have major impacts a very long way away from that. But I think in terms of just the almost semi-random decisions that we make in terms of landscape, it then ends up meaning that, yes, it's very difficult to untangle those impacts. But I mean, fundamentally, if at every 5 meter pixel, every 5 meter square in the landscape, you're able to accommodate an additional 5 millimeters of water, that's actually an awful lot less flow, say down the Waikato River or whatever it might be, which could be good in a flood situation, might be bad in a drought situation. But fundamentally, yeah, if you make enough changes, it's going to play out.
Does your modelling include social effects?
The computer models at the moment don't very much. We have been doing some cultural mapping work up with communities in the East Coast. So we're really interested in bringing that stuff in, and we're talking to, you know, like a variety of partners about how to kind of like fit our framework within broader frameworks. I mean, it's much harder to model a lot of the social people interactions than it is to model things like water and chemicals moving in the landscape.
There's a fantastic exhibit in a museum in Amsterdam. It's a big tabletop display, and it's water flowing down a catchment, and you can build dams and wood viaducts, or is it? You're just building dams, I think, to control the water physically, like with the little bricks, well, big bricks really, but the water flows. And if you manage to dry an area out, people build in it. And if you keep it dry for long enough, towns appear.
Yeah.
But then you have the problem that you can't then do anything with that because there's a town suddenly appeared.
That's right, and then you're locked in. Then you're locked in, absolutely.
I've looked and looked for exhibits, particularly museum exhibits, because it's, you know, the cutting edge of science education, science communication, for things that are actually teaching people to think in systems. And there's not that many.
No.
It was a really, really good example.
No, and that's one of the things that we're trying to do is find ways to better visualise how the impacts of these things play out. So there's that social aspect to it. So in terms of how we actually apply it, there's very much a social aspect, because one of the problems is that we're taking in generally just nationally available data, and there's all kinds of errors. The first thing you actually do is you go out and you talk to your stakeholders and you say, is this right? Often they actually nod and say, yep, it's fine. Then you actually show them the model results and they go, that's really wrong. And then you're able to trace back and go, oh, it's wrong because actually the soil's data is really rubbish, or this has happened. And then trying to take in their specific desires for the catchment. So, you know, my grandfather proposed to my grandmother in this field and they wanted to remain it as it is, or maybe if they didn't get on that well, they want to completely change it. So trying to take in those things, those other difficult to quantify a priori. Sorry, that's terrible jargon.
Do people need to understand what's going on inside the models in order to use it in decision-making?
It helps if they do. So I think the simpler you actually make the representation, the easier it is. So yes, we do try to make our models as simple as possible, but not simpler. And we try and explain what's going on. So, you know, soil has a limited capacity to absorb water. Sorry, I'm a hydrologist, so even though our system's got a lot more than hydrology in it, that tends to be the first thing I explain. So rather than try and build really detailed physics models with lots of differential equations, yes, so we try and keep it simple.
What sort of problems are you hoping that it can, I was going to say solve, but solve's probably pushing it too far, to help with?
Sure. Just better, more sustainable, more resilient land management, and management that's able to provide good outcomes for multiple stakeholders, and something that helps balance that kind of, you know, this regulation versus people's individual ability and freedom to actually make their own decisions about their landscapes. A lot of it is about looking at outcomes and saying, actually, this has got a positive benefit for this outcome, and this outcome. DOC can't pay everything, to get this positive biodiversity outcome, but actually this has got a positive benefit for drinking water, this has got a positive benefit for water quality, and also just find ways in which multiple people can actually contribute to that more sustainable, better land management. A lot of it is just bringing information to the table and allowing people to make more informed decisions.
One of the things
it's designed to do is that often decisions have just been made. People will go, I've planted 100 hectares worth of trees, I've done a good thing, and you know, there's all kinds of schemes around the world in terms of environmental footprinting that will take that as a positive. And it just seems such a waste if you're going to plant 100 hectares of trees not to make certain that you're actually putting those trees in places where they have maximum benefit. So it's partly just about making those things more efficient.
One of the things, as soon as you start talking to multiple stakeholders, is that it brings up multiple legitimate outcomes, mm-hmm. Things start to get wicked,
absolutely.
Things start to get messy.
Absolutely.
Are those sorts of things approachable from a mathematical modelling?
Yes, so far. I've been worried about that, of course, from the very beginning, and I've been waiting for people to start fighting about it, but so far people are pretty open, and you bring the information to the table, and I think it becomes, because it's not that judgmental, you're just coming along and going, you know, here's the data we've got. Okay, there's errors for it. Here's the simple modelling system. Here's what it's saying. What do you think about it? And because we're not saying, here is one prescriptive solution, so that's another thing the framework doesn't. It doesn't say, here is the best solution. It says, here's a whole lot of different things you can do. So it's not trying to say, this is what you have to do, because the most important thing is to improve, I don't know, biodiversity, to get the best amount of production out of the land now versus in 5 years or whatever it might be.
Have you had surprises in applying it? I'm thinking of the cases where you've like put everything in, turned the handle, and it said, this is the answer. And you thought, no, that can't be right. And then you look into it and you think, actually, we missed that. There is something in there. That's interesting finding that it was cleverer than you.
Yes. I'll generally, when that happens, I've just put a bug in the program somewhere, or as more and more people are contributing, it's, I can, you know, palm it off as a mistake by somebody else. But yes, for sure. And I think, I mean, one of the points about models is that environmental systems are so complicated, and we do understand the basics of what's going on fairly well, but our minds, I think, just can't comprehend what happens again when you look at all of the various configurations of this particular soil with this particular land management type, etc., and how they all come together. So often you actually just don't have a clue what's going to happen. But yes, sometimes things are higher or lower than you expect. I've had not so much with this particular model, but with a different model, one where suddenly the flow reversed, and we thought that was obviously a really bad bug in the model, but actually it was because there were some abstractions and the flow actually was reversing. So yes, sometimes.
Oh, well. Henrik Moller talks about how we need to be focusing our efforts on the production landscapes, that we've think about biodiversity in the city, we think about biodiversity in the national parks,
yep.
But there's these big gaps in between that we do a good job of ignoring.
Yeah,
it sounds to me as though this is particularly focused at addressing the same sustainability of that in the middle.
Yes, absolutely. And I've been in conversations with DOC recently, and that's one of the reasons why they're interested in this framework, is because they see, and it's not, it's also the amount of conservation land that's actually bordering farms. Absolutely.
What he suggests is that we should be paying farmers to look after the land.
Well, they do that in a lot of countries around the world. So, yes, there's this. And I think in New Zealand, most of it it's either legislatory, like a regulatory stick, or it's consultation. I mean, a lot of the regional councils are going out and really trying to consult with communities in terms of finding solutions, but there doesn't seem to be much money available for these payments for ecosystem services. So
if a council was wanting to approach that question, and they came to you and said, we want to use your modelling approach to explore this, can you talk us through the process of how you would...
Well, we already do that in other countries. So we part of the funding for Lucy has actually come from the Welsh Government, and it's being applied as part of a very big project that's monitoring the agricultural subsidy scheme, which is currently called Glastera. It's about to move to another name soon. And so there really are payments for environmental and social and, you know, maintaining a cultural landscape, etc. So we already do that. In fact, there'll be a great talk in, I think, Antwerp in September on the potential of using Lucy for payments for ecosystem services, if you'd like to like to attend. So yes, we're already exploring that question in other countries. And also in England, so DEFRA have got an environmental stewardship scheme, and so one of the things, we've had a project with them that said, what benefits did our subsidies actually do? So they paid farmers for specific actions like taking stock out of paddocks in winter, you know, restoring moorland, restoring peats, etc., and said, what's the baseline? Because they just didn't have enough monitoring, and so they were forced to go to a modelling system to look at the effects. But if we'd spent the same amount of money, or if we'd just done the same outcome for less cost, you know, what does that look like? So we've used Lucy to do that, and very much saying, here are the optimum places if you're wanting to kind of achieve these outcomes, and yes, you can do it at less cost, or yes, spend this money, and again, target the spatial optimum places to get those outcomes.
So, if a council approaches you, or DOC, mm-hmm. or somebody approaches yep. you and says, we've got this problem, one you haven't dealt with before, mm-hmm. let's make one up. River flows. No, you've all done that lots of times.
Yeah, give me a harder one.
So, if we take an example such as the Shag River, goes below low flow yep. all the time.
Yep.
Would this be useful to explore why that might be happening and what to do about it?
Yes. Yes, absolutely, although that kind of sounds like a fairly simple problem to resolve. I mean, if it's the trees, go and just check where the groundwater level is and otherwise do a bit of a simple, you know, like mass balance in terms of the amount of abstractions versus the natural flow. So yes, absolutely, you could use Lucy to do that. But
you see,
that's possibly yeah. applying, you know, too sophisticated an approach.
Yes, but that's kind of the problem, is that it is quite simple science, yet it seems to be an almost unsolvable political problem.
Mm.
And so what do we need to do to get the science to actually impact the decision making?
Yeah, sure. And I think you might be right that actually we could kind of like come along with a, you know, like a nationally set up and an internationally accepted framework and run that through, and people might then have more confidence than if the council just says, well, look, we'll go and we'll do these measurements and here's what we think, because it's already a for and against. So that's the social element of it. Mm.
How hard is it to introduce new things into your model? I'm not sure if it deals with tussock burning, for example.
It deals with burning, although again, if we're going to try and do tussock burning specifically, I'd want to kind of like go and think very carefully about how well that was represented.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very easy. I mean, something like that would be extremely easy, but it's built to be modular. It's built to talk to other models and talk to other frameworks. And as time goes on, basically, every time we go into a new area, there's something a little bit different which we add in that then almost always ends up being useful when we take it to the next place.
And again, the challenge is that people will say, but we know about this stuff. How could you possibly know about it? We've been looking after this land for 100 and something years.
I think it depends on the attitude to which you come to them. So I think if you come and go, I've got the answers, then they're very unreceptive, and fair enough, because they've always got an awful lot of local knowledge, which is why part of the way in which we always start applying the framework, or normally, ideally, when we apply the framework, is we go and we say, here's what we've got. We're bringing in national data. We're bringing in, you know, this process understanding, the scientific understanding. There's going to be local things that we're not representing. It's probably going to be issues in the data. And we basically bring that in, and it's a sharing of information. And I think that's really important. So we don't come in saying, we've got the answers, we've got everything perfect. And we come in and we say, there's some stuff that we can bring to the table, the stuff that you can bring to the table. And so part of it is actually checking that information, checking what additional things need to be built in that landscape, what local knowledge is there that we haven't got incorporated.
How do you deal with uncertainty?
Oh, I like uncertainty. Math geek. So we are, there's different ways, and you know, whether you're talking about visualizing uncertainty too. So one aspect is communicating uncertainty, and there are certainly certain parts which we are more confident than others, and we're exploring ways of mapping those.
Because as soon as you put a line on the map, people think it's.
I know, exactly, and that's a real danger that we've found, because we produce these pretty maps, and we're going to start to do, you know, 3D visualizations. So that's going to be even more pretty and even more believable. That's actually, I find that more of an issue than people going, well, we don't believe you. That's actually more, oh, great, yeah, we'll run away with that. So we are looking at ways to, you know, like present fuzzy information or show where it is or isn't, and also looking at ways to kind of like track uncertainty through the landscape, because there are certain places where kind of uncertainty inflates. So you might end up being very uncertain about, again, the best place to, you know, modify your tillage practices on a hill slope. But actually, once you get down to looking at the broader catchment, it might become less important. And this kind of like comes down to your, what did you call it? Your sort of diminishing returns, but... But there are certain things which become very important at some scales. So uncertainty can actually, change, grow and expand and contract as it goes through the landscape, really.
And people don't even understand the basic concepts of scientific uncertainty.
No, I mean, there's all kinds of issues in how you communicate uncertainty. And again, that's quite recently that policymakers started to embrace the idea of this uncertainty even being communicated. They said, just, you know, give us the line in the sand. But of course, you know, one of the things we do is we say, well, we, on average, this kind of change will have a positive effect. But actually, this one has a similar. It might have a slightly less effect, but it's slightly more certain. So, if you're able to make 100 changes, you might be better to make the less certain ones, because on average they'll be a larger change. But if you can only make a couple, you might be better to actually take the slightly less on average good, because you're more certain that each individual instance will be a good. If that makes sense. Not really.
Do we know what's going to happen with climate change?
No, we don't know what's going to happen with climate change, but, I mean, we can explore that. So that's part of the point in terms of exploring how, you know, land management and climate change together might impact on these various things, and also looking at how climate change might impact on where you might want to change crops, or where you've got a more or less risk in terms of habitats, again, whether that's because sediment or flow or quality have changed, or you know, temperatures for which species... like to inhabit change. So we can play games, but of course there's all kinds of uncertainties in this, in the projected scenarios, and all kinds of uncertainties in the underpinning science behind those scenarios.
Which is, so it's hardly surprising, given the number of times you said uncertainty in that paragraph, that decision makers don't really know where to start.
No. It's not surprising. I mean, we do have pretty good ideas of what the trends are going to be. So in terms of which places are likely to be more drought prone and which places are likely to be wetter, etc., where temperatures are likely to increase. It's really hard. Yeah.
Is this perhaps the next thing that needs doing in climate science, that there's extensive models, 20s, whatever it is, different competing models doing the climate, the global climate modelling. But as far as I can see, an awful lot less certainty or less maturity in the models for what does that mean?
Maybe. I mean, we do. And in fact, just a couple of hours ago, I had a colleague in, and we were talking about how we were going to propagate, you know, climate uncertainties through Lucy and through some other models to have a look at that. I mean, I've been involved in several projects that have taken, quite a lot of projects which have taken climate projections and run them through. So we do those uncertainties. I don't.
Does your model have, is it a single model, or can you have competing understandings?
You can, absolutely, and that's really important. So competing hypotheses, absolutely. Yeah, that's incredibly important. Yeah. And so you can either go, here is the situation, I believe that these processes are dominant, so then just kind of like pick from the sweet mix, the ones you want. But you can also say, actually, we're going to run it through, a variety of different models and look at how that plays out.
Can you have... whole different modelling approaches? competing, or is it within the same model? You're just changing the parameters and rebuilding
different model structures. Yes, different model structures.
Oh, okay. Yep. So you could come in with, I want to express an indigenous view of how this might work.
Well,
or is that pushing it too far?
Express an indigenous view of how that might work. Well, tell me the indigenous view, and I'll tell you how well we can.
I suppose the different indigenous views are not so much on the how the system is going to respond, but it's different philosophies and value sets in the management.
Very different, yes, absolutely. So so we've been working with Ngāti Porou, and or not with Ngāti Porou as an overarching entity, but with members of Ngāti Porou, for example, and looking at... So other things, yes, become very important. So, you know, there's a battleground, and so, you know, they don't want to be planting any crops in the path that water and sediment take from that battleground. And so you end up with a different set of criteria. So, again, there might be a parasite from a different hapu, you know, 300 years ago or whatever. And so they don't want that accessed, you know, certain planting is appropriate, and certain uses aren't. So we look at taking that into account. That's quite nice because it's a very holistic view, which, of course, is what we're trying to do. And it's, first trying to actually explain it from that very Western science, very isolated. Water works this way, sediment works this way, biodiversity works this way. And, of course, we're trying to actually integrate everything, and they start with that, which is fantastic. So rather than actually breaking things up and layering things together, they actually start with the holistic, and then you might break things down into individual layers, individual maps as a kind of a second stage. So it's almost the reverse of how Western science has worked.
I've heard a lot of people say, have words to the effect of, we need to stop understanding the pieces, or we need to stop focusing on just understanding the pieces and really work on putting it back together again.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that this is a vehicle for doing that.
Yeah.
You say it's a decision support tool.
Yeah.
In the long run, how do you see it being used?
So I would hope that it is used to support decisions, again, across scales as well as across multiple environmental, social, economic outcomes. So it actually creates a dialogue between individual landowners, stakeholders, you know, recreational users of land, iwi. The iwi then work at a similar level to the regional councils and the national government. So governance at all these different scales. So individuals versus the... a multi-way kind of like information exchange system where people can actually negotiate outcomes and consider what's happening. Consider outcomes that actually help each people with at each individual block of land, etc. All the various all the various interests associated with that, as well as the big wider national or regional scale outcomes, which might be like maintaining the Kerru population. water quality in Lake Taupo or Rotorua, but also, maintaining the values and the livelihoods and all the various values that are inherent in land at the smaller scales as well.
My old favourite definition of sustainability was ethics extended across space and time.
Yeah.
How could ethics. Your modelling approach help that understanding? I suppose what it's doing is providing the platform for you to be asking those questions, particularly the questions of across space, mm-hmm. that if I'm doing this thing over here, how does it affect people over there?
Yep.
And possibly highlighting those ethical issues.
That's exactly what it is doing. And of course, there are some scary things inherent in that as well. Whether you get it wrong or right, but again, if you're actually potentially highlighting a particular area as being a source of, so for example, bad water quality. And it might not even be because it might not be anything to do with the management of that area too. It might actually just be that the geology, etc., of that is just such that it's that in its pristine state, or that even under what would in any other system be good management, it just still finds a route down through the waterways too quickly. But yeah, I think that's a reasonable definition. But sustainability, yeah, I'm interested in sustainability over space and time, resilience over space and time.
And over time, at the root of sustainability really is intergenerational equity.
Yep.
How would you see it contributing to embedding that? At the moment, we don't have somebody from 50 years hence sitting around a council table. But maybe a robot version of your system could be that. Because you could run things forward for a long time.
We can run things forward for 50 or 100 years and look at the outcomes, obviously changing dependent on whatever your climate change predictions are, whatever your predictions are of how, you know, land use, land management will evolve, and you know, anything else that impacts on the system.
Mm. And even if they're not right,
they still help dialogue, and they still help people think about what those implications are. And you know, most people want the next generations to have a good, I guess, inheritance is the old way of saying it.
Okay, my new favourite definition of sustainability, I'm going to ask you if yours in a minute, is contribution to a positive socio-ecological transformation.
Contribution to a positive social,
yep,
economic,
socio-ecological.
Okay, yep. I prefer that, socio-ecological.
You can have the economic, but only as a means to,
yep,
to doing these other things.
Well, I'd say that's not. That sounds like very positive in terms of that's what everybody should be doing to actually move towards sustainability. But I guess for something to be sustainable, fundamentally, it. Maybe it is or it isn't, and I'm not sure anything is sustainable from every single kind of like viewpoint in every single future. Probably there's very little we could ever say is truly sustainable. But what you're talking about is not so much a definition of sustainability, but a definition of how to move to sustainability, I guess. Because if everyone makes a positive action, you still might not get there.
No, but it's better than going the other way.
Absolutely, yeah, sure.
And so what I'm wondering is some places talk about having triple bottom line accounting, but what they really mean is they're either just counting energy, carbon,
yeah,
along with the real bottom line, the financial bottom line, or in fact they're not even doing that and they're just saying, okay, and we'll write some nice things about our corporate social,
yeah,
good. But there is a possibility to have an indicator of the extent to which this decision is contributing to this,
sure,
socio-ecological transformation.
Sure.
But in order to do that, we need integrated modelling, which your system could do.
Yeah. But we also need the indicators, which actually are a separate question, and I've been at various meetings, national and international, which are talking about, you know, just what those indicators should be.
But your model could feed the, or drive those indicators and tell us where they might be heading.
Yeah, absolutely, but someone's got to come up with the indicators. I mean, people have come up with draft ideas of indicators, but mm-hmm, it's a big area of work.
But again, we're going in the right direction.
We are going in the right direction. There's all kinds of exciting things happening, and you know, in New Zealand and also internationally, and you know, the UN's got this system of environmental economic accounting happening. I'm a bit involved in the experimental ecosystem accounts part of that, and they really are now kind of like trying to make, well, they will be making countries responsible for reporting on what at the moment is just a very limited set of indicators, and they're exploring other indicators, but, and you know, in the end they want a really wide swathe of them. So there's some really positive things happening for sure.
So what is your go-to definition of sustainability?
And this is very embarrassing, but I don't really have one. Because again, I think about, you know, what is sustainable, and I start to think about all the various things in which that encompasses, and I don't have one that I actually feel is all encompassing. So yeah, I'm certainly very interested in working in the sustainability space.
And you'll know if it's in that space, but.
I know.
Yeah, I know sustainable when I see it.
Well, no. No.
If
sustainability in certain outcomes, but...
We're writing a book about these interviews. We're calling it Tomorrow's Heroes. And what we want to do is to describe people's superpowers. They're what are they bringing to the to this sustainable superhero action team? How would you like your superpower to be described?
Just one.
Can't have flight. Can't stop trains.
No, I certainly can't. I guess... Well, what I actually hope to achieve is I hope to bring this information that allows people to make these decisions across space and time, thinking in a very holistic, integrated manner. And I am really trying just to bring information and to be non-judgmental and to give people, you know, a platform. That's not a superpower, though. I'm just a maths geek, unfortunately. I'm not a superhero.
What is the big... Yes, but people are going to... The point is that we're hoping that people will look back in 20 years and say, that was good. I'm pleased they did that. They're our heroes. So if we can figure that out, then that's what we need to bottle. That's what we need to get people doing. What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Last couple of years. The biggest success I've had is coming up, with collaborators, with colleagues. So it's not just me. I lead it, but it's not just me. With this framework, and I think it is a step forward because we are now able to look at the impact of fine spatial scale and fine configuration on, you know, just a big variety of ecosystem services. And I think that's...
I like the name for your framework, by the way.
Yeah, we spend a lot of time thinking about it. Problem is sometimes now people just call me Lucy.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
No. Yes, in that I am acting to try and create change. I believe very strongly in the importance of what I'm doing. And I actually choose not to be an activist. I actually try and keep certain environmental opinions to myself, because I think it's really important that I am as objective as possible in putting this framework together, in terms of bringing the science to the table, making it as something that everybody can connect to. And so far I've had pretty good success because people with a very wide range of views, in terms of how the environment in particular could be managed, all seem to connect to it quite well.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
I really enjoy what I do. I do feel I'm making a difference to the world. And it's quite a pretty world, really. I mean, look at the mountains and look at the sea. I like getting out into it.
We should say that we're in a corner office.
Oh, yeah, I've got
with a stunning view.
Across the harbour, looking at the mountains. Yeah, as long as I can see mountains and sea, I'm pretty, or water of some form.
What challenges are you looking forward to in the next couple of years?
I am looking forward to, more and more of my students getting out and bringing, not just the interesting research that we're doing, but also the ideas that they're all coming up with, taking that into the world. I'm looking forward to Lucy moving forward. There's a lot of interest coming in, both internationally and nationally at the moment, and I'm kind of gearing up. Got some really good collaborations forming, and so I am hoping that, in a couple of years, we'll have something which is being applied quite broadly in New Zealand, and helping to make these better, at least environmental decisions at the moment, and hopefully bring in much more of the social and economic dimensions going forward as well.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would you like it to be?
It doesn't have very much to do with my work, actually. I'm afraid it would be one of those terrible things that they say in Miss Universe or something. I'd just like, world peace, and that's just too much terrible stuff going on around.
If you go for that, I've got a follow-up question. Okay, if you're going to have that, what's the smallest thing that we could do that would make the biggest possible difference?
I don't know, because the obvious things are probably, yeah, taking in more refugees, showing a bit less fear of other people and other cultures and a little bit more inclusiveness. I'm sure actually that there's the smallest things possible are probably some very small esoteric political things in reality. But actually that has been, it's nothing to do with my work, but it has been on my mind, because normally I feel actually really fulfilled and I feel like I'm making a difference. And right now what's going on in the world, all the turmoil, I'm kind of wondering if it is going to...
I talked to Hans Brunix, who's the head of the European Environment Agency, and he said that they come under criticism for only sort of focusing on the decision makers.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's 500 million people, minus however many are in the UK, that could be convinced. Why are they only focusing on 27? And he says that those are the ones that are going to make the difference.
Yeah, that would be right.
If we can convince them, that's what we need.
Yeah, that would be right.
That's what we need to do.
That would be why my gut instinct is to actually to kind of let go. We just need to try and look after these people, and everybody should try and do that. But yeah, my mind says no. There's going to be a few really key people, and if you could influence those, that would be the most important thing.
Can Lucy help that?
No, I don't think so. Wish I could say yes. Maybe that's not completely true, because again, I think water security, food security, energy security are all really important, and we are looking at actually bringing in energy and food. So it does a bit of food, it does much less energy, but we've actually got a collaboration with the University of Queensland, with it looking at mining and things. So we really want to do the energy, the food, the water. Again, this is really important across scales, and that lets you look at the international dimensions, again, not just the national dimensions or the catchment scale dimensions. So yeah, and I think, again, security in those and bringing information to the table will help with some of those things for sure. But
and
not everything, not what's going on in Syria here at the moment.
Lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
I guess just think about, whenever you're thinking about sustainability, try and think beyond just the specific issue. So sustainability of, again, whether it's land, sustainability of the political system, sustainability of the Ruatane for jam. just start to think of all the other complexities and how those might be balanced. It's not particularly exciting message, is it? Sorry.
Works for me. Thank you very much.
Thank
for
you.
Having me. You've been listening to Sustainable Lens of Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz. and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we're building up a searchable archive of people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens was that of Dr. Bethana Jackson, senior lecturer in the School of Geography, Environment and Earth Sciences at Victoria University. Is that geography split out, or is that geography and some extra bits?
Geography, environment and earth sciences. Yeah, we'd quite like to find a shorter name that kind of summarises what all of us do, but it's just finding a shorter name that all of us agree with.
Environment and earth sciences, what geography does? Or have they got geology and stuff in under
I am
well?
Not giving an opinion on that on radio.
You're in the Cotton Building. He was a geologist and a geographer. He was the first geography chair, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Where did I get to? You can follow the links on sustainablelens.org to find us on Facebook to keep in touch, and you can listen to Sustainable Lens via all the potty places, including iTunes. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.